Hello, welcome again to the Telegram podcast, being broadcast live as a Google Plus Hangout, live on the www. Today we're going to be talking about foreign policy. We're discussing particularly Ukraine and Syria. And I'm joined by David Blair and by Con Coughlin, both at the Telegraph, who are experts in that field. If you want to comment on anything we say, you can drop us a line on Twitter using the hashtag HangWithTim. Or you can take a look at our Google Plus Hangout page on the website, where you can post lots of comments, and I promise you, I will be taking a look at the comments as they come, and I will share them with the viewers at the end of the program. First of all, before we get on to discuss the very serious stuff, I just want to pick up on a development in the world of foreign correspondence. A new poll by PKF Hospitality Research has found that income from minibars in hotel rooms has fallen by 28%. Between 2007 and 2012. So the question I want to ask you two chaps, because like me, you travel the world, go to very glamorous locations, etc., etc. Does the minibar matter? Do you use it anymore? I don't use it at all. I never touch it.
Usually the standard of hotels I find myself as a foreign correspondent, they don't have minibars.
Right. Okay.
And often the countries I go to, alcohol is banned.
Right.
So it's rather a pointless exercise.
But what about the hotel bar? Does that still matter to the foreign correspondent?
Well, the harsh truth is that these days newspapers won't pay all bar bills.
Right.
And they certainly won't pay all minibar bills. In fact, the word minibar is toxic if you submit it on a hotel bill to our expenses system. So that puts a dampener on things. It means that if you're going to hang out at those places, you have to do it at your own expense. And foreign correspondents, of course, are not paid very much. And by and large, they're a bunch of skinflints anyway. So it's not quite as much fun as it used to be.
Okay, because it used to be the case that you get all the best stories at the hotel bar?
No, you had the best fights about stories at the hotel bar with various egos clashing over who got the best line, who got the best splash, and of course accusations that some stories perhaps weren't as truthful as the writer would like to pretend they were.
Okay, well, thank you both very much. We're going to talk now, of course, about the serious matter, which is Ukraine and Russia. It now looks as though much of the eastern part of the country is under the control of Vladimir Putin. If that's the case, how dangerous is this standoff? What can be done about it? And how do we get into this situation? David Blair, you've just returned from Ukraine. What have you seen, and what does it tell you about what's happening?
Well, building by building, pro-Russian activists are taking control of two regions in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk. It's happening inexorably. Just about every day we wake up to the news of a further occupation. There's now about a dozen towns and cities across those two regions where pro-Russian separatists have taken control of key installations, including now a television station. And the government of Ukraine has no answer to this. They tried a military operation to restore their control, and it failed completely. And it's very difficult to see what else they can possibly do. And now they're reaching the point where they're quite candidly admitting that these regions are pretty much out of their control. And that's a big deal, because if you take Donetsk region on its own, that's 10% of Ukraine's entire population. About 4.5 million people live there. It's the industrial heartland of the country, and it produces about 2/3 of the country's coal. So these are big losses. These are big, important territories that Kiev is gradually seeing slip out of its control.
Now, are they being taken over, in your opinion, by people who are masquerading as genuine separatists, or is there now a genuine separatist movement?
There is a genuine movement, but you shouldn't exaggerate its support. It's very clear when you go to, for example, Donetsk City, that the people carrying out the occupations are not huge in number. You're talking about a few hundred individuals who are actually carrying out the occupations, probably supported by a few thousand more. But that's it. So in a city of 1 million people, most of the population seem to be pretty much indifferent. Now, you could read that as passive support for the occupations, mm-hmm. But equally you could read that as a sign of such profound disillusionment that people there don't really believe that it would make a difference to their lives, whoever is in charge.
But if it's so small, and we do keep on reading about a handful of people taking over a police station or occupying a town hall, if it is so small, why can't Kiev deal with it?
Because their own army simply doesn't have the means or the will. And what you have is the security forces in these areas of Ukraine were only a few months ago battling on the streets of Kiev in the Maidan against the very people who now control the government. So you're asking people who were enemies to cooperate, and it's very, very difficult, and it simply isn't happening. And there are also straightforward economic reasons. For example, policemen are paid a great deal more in Russia than they are in Ukraine. So if you suggest to an ordinary officer that it might be worth his while to be part of Russia instead of part of Ukraine, he might find that attractive. But the essential fact is that the evidence suggests that support for joining Russia in the east of Ukraine is still a minority cause. Mm-hmm. There's two key bits of evidence. The first is an opinion poll that was conducted just a few weeks ago, which found that in Donetsk, for example, only 28% of people want to join Russia. Right. 52% were in favor of staying within Ukraine. The rest were don't knows. And the second is that Ukraine had a referendum back in December 1991 on the occasion of the breakup of the Soviet Union, or whether to be independent or not. And across the country, support for independence was about 90%. And in the east, it was about 80%. So the evidence suggests that if you gave people a free and fair vote, the outcome might well be that they would choose to stay in Ukraine. And of course, there is a referendum, which the people who've taken over Donetsk have promised by May the 11th. And it will be very interesting to see how they actually deliver that.
When you've been in the east and you've met Ukrainians, what has their reaction been? Do they want Kiev to act? Do those people want to remain part of Ukraine? How do they fit into this narrative?
They face a real dilemma. I mean, on the one hand, they don't want to be handed over to Russia. On the other hand, they don't want to be the focus of a military operation launched by their own government. Plus, they have their own grievances. This is a part of the country which is the industrial heartland, but of course most of those industries are completely uncompetitive. It's a rust belt now. Unemployment is extremely high. The economy has been in trouble for very many years. And so they feel as a neglected and marginalized population by both sides, by both Kiev and by Moscow. So there's a great deal of internal discontent, quite apart from the wider crisis that we find ourselves in now.
Okay. Con, in your opinion, how much is Russia reacting to events, and how much is it driving events? Do you think there is a separatist revolution going on that is simply exploiting or reacting to, or do you think we can actually see its hand in it?
Well, I think if we just delve into the bowels of the Kremlin, and in particular to the headquarters of the FSB, the External Security Service, and found their master plan for the future of Russia, I think you would find that a lot of very senior people in Russia want to reclaim Russia's historic influence over territories near its borders. Now, whether this amounts to full-scale occupation stroke annexation, as we saw in Crimea, is a moot point. But we've already seen in places like Moldova, the Russians trying to extend their influence. They've been playing around in the Balkans. From what David's saying, clearly the Russians are very active. And it's in Russia's interest to keep Ukraine unstable. And of course, when you go back to the genesis of this whole crisis, the thing that really worried Moscow was that it saw Ukraine, or Kiev rather, tilting towards the EU, towards Western institutions. And this really, for them, was a red line. But I think they reacted more to the events in Ukraine. I suspect, if they've done a post-mortem at the Kremlin over Ukraine, they will concede that they were taken aback by the speed of events after Yanukovych tore up the deal with the EU. But having been presented with this opportunity, clearly they're making the most of it. And the question now is just how far they are prepared to go to further secure their influence, let alone occupation, but their influence over these territories.
Okay. Presuming that we should do something, and I'll pick up on that in a moment, do you think sanctions can work?
Well, yes, I think, and in fact, in my column tomorrow, I'm going to argue that Putin himself has now had a wake-up call. If you look at what is going on with the Russian economy, the ruble's gone down by 10% in the last week or so. Interest rates are going up. There's been a phenomenal flight of foreign capital. $63 billion has come out in the last month or so. I'm told that the Russian bank has actually had to sort of fly money in to fly dollars in to prop up its foreign currency reserves. So, and all this sort of signals to Putin that, you know, actions have consequences. And of course, the problem for the Russian economy, it was already in a difficult position. This has exacerbated its plight. And there will be a lot of people around Putin, a lot of people who've made a lot of money as a result of their loyalty to Putin, who are now saying, well, you know, is it really worth all this? Mm. Add to that the sort of very modest gestures by NATO, but clearly the Americans have put their F-15s up in the Baltic states. We're deploying some Tornadoes. We're planning some exercises in that area. There's a big NATO meeting next week to discuss just how far NATO will go. We know that there are problems within the alliance, particularly with the Germans, but there is also a sort of a willingness in Washington and Europe to just demonstrate that, you know, we're not going to sit by idly and let Putin walk all over Central and Eastern Europe.
David, that will's taken a long time to develop. Why so slow?
Well, imposing sanctions on Russia is not a cost-free exercise. Mm-hmm. Europe's dependence on Russian energy supplies is very well known. But Con is exactly right. The Russian economy is in no position to withstand serious sanctions from the West. You know, the essential reality is that Russia's economy is about the size of Italy's. They have more than twice the population of Britain, but their total GDP is actually more than 20% smaller than ours. And compared with America, Russia's economy is not much more than a tenth of the size of America's. So if the whole of Europe and America gang up on what is essentially an Italy-sized economy, mm-hmm. it doesn't take any great intelligence to work out who's going to lose.
They have a larger military than Italy, though, of course.
Well, of course, they have enormous military power,
yeah.
But that's constrained by NATO.
Right.
And I think it's very interesting to look at the tactics that Vladimir Putin is using, because he hasn't invaded eastern Ukraine, at least not in the classical sense, by sending tanks and troops across an international frontier. Instead, what he's doing day by day is attempting to seize de facto control over two regions in particular through this extraordinary combination of internal subversion, intelligence operations, the use of popular militias, stirring up popular support in those areas. It's a very interesting kind of warfare. It's special warfare, if you like. Mm-hmm. Now, what it's designed to do is to avoid triggering those sanctions which would cause such damage to the Russian economy. Because the West has been very clear that we've drawn our red line. The red line is the invasion of eastern Ukraine. Yeah. If you invade eastern Ukraine, all bets are off. Then we impose what President Obama calls sectoral sanctions, which means we will hammer the Russian energy and financial services industries.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye Gazprom.
Bye-bye Gazprom. So Putin's response to that is to say, okay, well, I will attempt to achieve my objective by not crossing your red line, by holding back from an invasion, at least in the historic sense, and by using this extraordinary method of internal subversion. And by and large, as of today, he's succeeding. And right. He is still winning this encounter, because inch by inch, day by day, eastern Ukraine is slipping de facto into his control.
Con, you implied, although imply is not the right word, you simply stated that it's impossible to have a normal diplomatic relationship with Russia. Because they lie.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Well, it's quite obvious, actually. I mean, we saw in that rather wonderful press conference that Putin gave at the time of the Crimea crisis, there was a stage-managed group of Russian journalists, and he looked at the camera and said very bluntly, there are no Russian troops in Crimea, when the area was crawling with Russian Spetsnaz forces. And of course, you know, if you look back over history, I was just sort of looking up the history books, and Lord Curzon, when he was Viceroy of India, basically said, when he had his own concerns about Russia, you can't trust a word they say. And in fact, John Kerry picked up this theme this week when he said, you know, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, is very adept at trying to persuade you that black is white.
Yeah.
And I think it's very important, because this is a very big crisis. I mean, it is changing the way we address the whole sort of global security picture. And it's very important to know that when you're dealing with the Russians, whether it's over Ukraine or Syria or Iran, that they're not very trustworthy. And you know, we tend to play by the rules when we negotiate a deal or we come to an agreement. But if the other side is basically telling barefaced lies, that makes it a rather difficult proposition.
But we can make presumptions about what the Russians are doing on the basis of what their traditional national interests are. And although everything that we've described may well be bordering on breaking international law, in some cases it probably does.
There's no question it does.
Right, okay. The
annexation of Crimea is a breach of international law.
Fair enough. But it is in Russia's traditional national interests. I mean, they're
to break the law.
Well, yes, it is. It is. It is, especially if you can get away with it. In which case, double standard might not be exactly ethical, but it does serve a national interest.
Well, it might do, but I think the counter-argument to that is it is going to be very much against Russia's national interest if the consequences of undertaking these actions is it destroys the Russian economy, which is what we've been talking about. And you know, Russia is a very vulnerable state. It is not the great Soviet superpower of old. It is a modest country with rather greater ambitions. And if it pursues this kind of illegal conduct, then it's going to pay a price. And that price is going to be very painful for the Russians. And I would argue that is not in Russia's national interest. And I think, you know, unless there is a change in Putin or a moderation in Putin's position, I think a lot of people in Russia are going to wake up and think, well, you know, why is he doing this? We don't need to do this. It's not in our interests, not in our economic interests. It's not for our greater well-being. You know, Ukraine is not a threat to Russia.
Yeah.
And I think the EU's probably learned its lesson. I mean, I think nobody in the EU really expects Ukraine to be doing any deals with Brussels anytime soon.
But a lot of our viewers will be asking themselves, is it in Britain's interests to get involved? It might have been Russia's interest to get involved, but it's certainly not in our interest to get involved. We have no fight to pick with Russia. Ukraine is many, many miles away. It is of very little strategic or economic interest to us. Why should we care about it, especially given that we have a history of turning a blind eye to things that Russia does? I mean, we didn't do anything when they invaded Hungary. We didn't do anything when they invaded Czechoslovakia. We didn't do anything when they allowed the crushing of Solidarity in Poland. We suddenly are picking a fight with them over Ukraine. I think some people will be asking themselves, why does it matter?
Well, there's 2 points. First of all, when one country starts grabbing a chunk of another by force, that is a breach of the entire system of international relations which has existed since 1945. You
know, right.
This is attacking the central principle of international order and peace, which is that countries don't grab territory from one another, that countries don't annex chunks of one another. And as the moment you do that, every country has an interest in preventing that from happening. And secondly, if we look at the specifics here, we, for good or ill, are bound by treaty to go to war, if necessary, to defend the three Baltic states, because they're members of NATO. So under Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, an attack on them is the equivalent to an attack on Portsmouth or Edinburgh. You know, we are bound to defend them. So the great danger is, that if Putin succeeds in Ukraine, then his targets may go beyond that. And they may even, in extremis, end up being the Baltic states. And then we do find ourselves in a war. So the objective is to stop him now, because the costs of stopping him later will be that much greater.
But there's to add to what David's saying, is that there's a wider problem as well. If the Russians get away with their behavior in Ukraine and elsewhere, then that gives a green flag to other countries with these irredentist claims. For example, how long would it be before China occupied Taiwan, for example? And so you open a whole can of worms. And remember, you know, Britain is a member of P5 at the Security Council. We have international obligations to uphold the framework that David has explained. And it is in our national interest that there is global stability, because that protects our trade, that protects our economy, that protects our freedoms. And we actually make a small contribution militarily to these commitments. But we still have, in my view, an obligation to uphold these standards.
We also have an obligation in the interests of our own citizens to avoid potential conflict that could spark a war. It is true we've made treaty obligations in the past, but a treaty, frankly, can easily be torn up and thrown away and forgotten.
Look at the way we've responded to Crimea and Ukraine. And it hasn't been a very measured response. It has been what the diplomats call a soft power response. And we've been looking at the weak spots in the Russian armory, the economy, diplomatic isolation, social isolation. The oligarchs are not feeling so easy running around Harvey Nicks at the moment. And that has actually had an impact. And not a shot has been fired in anger by the Western alliance. But at some point, you'd still have to make it clear that if the Russians, for example, will start flying their jets over Latvia or Lithuania or somewhere, that they may well be intercepted and shot down by a NATO warplane. I mean, the Russians need to be aware of the limits of their room for manoeuvre.
And that's the point, isn't it, that if we stop them in Ukraine, we hopefully prevent them trying to extend their power and influence into the Baltics, and therefore we avoid a wider conflict.
That's right. And also we should be clear, the sort of effort that Britain is involved in at the moment to contain Russian ambitions in Ukraine is not a hugely costly effort.
Mm-hmm.
No one for a moment has suggested using force or putting troops on the ground, and the sorts of economic steps that have been taken so far have imposed minimal cost on the British economy. The sorts of economic steps that might be necessary in the future would have some impact on us, but far less of an impact than what they would have on Russia.
Okay. Let's move on. Let's close by discussing what we now know about Syria as a result of the Telegraph's investigations. What exactly have we ascertained in the past week?
Through a series of independent tests of soil samples brought out of Syria, the Telegraph has been able to establish that two particular villages were subjected to chlorine and ammonia gas attacks on three occasions during the course of April. Now, these attacks have been reported in the past, but there's been no conclusive evidence to show that poison gas has actually been used until now. So now we're able to say that once again the Syrian regime is gassing civilian populations in northern Syria.
Given that we now know that conclusively, and it was so important as a part of the debate in Parliament, how do you think this now, in retrospect, makes that debate look?
Well, the fundamental problem the West has had with Syria is trying to work out what would happen if we did intervene. And when the British intelligence services tell us that the biggest concern they face at the moment is British jihadists going to Syria and coming back radicalized and trained to carry out terrorist operations, that means we really shouldn't be supporting the rebels because we're just aiding and abetting them. We don't want the Assad regime to survive either. It's a wicked regime. It's responsible for the bulk of the 150,000 or so people who have been killed in the three-year civil war so far. So what's left? I think really this is an opportunity to go back to Geneva. Geneva's a very busy place at the moment. There's a lot of activity there over Ukraine, over Iran. Well, let's also get Syria back on the agenda. And I think a lot of this discussion has focused on how we've put Russia on the back foot with the measures we've taken over Ukraine. I don't see why we can't just extend that to Syria and point out to the Russians, who are one of the main backers of the Assad regime, that if they really want to support a regime that is gassing its own people, that is a heavy cross to bear.
Again, we come back to Russia, don't we? And is that if we were to force Russia to remove that support, could we seriously damage Assad?
Without Russian support, Assad would probably fall, or
right,
at least face a terrible crisis. But Russia is going to carry on supporting Assad. There's nothing we can do to compel Russia to withdraw that support. Russia has no shame, it seems, about supporting a regime that actually gasses its own people. Russia has an elaborate array of conspiracy theories to try and shuffle off responsibility for that. So they will simply say that, they have two positions. First of all, they say that there's been no chemical weapons attacks. And then when it's proved that there have been, they say, they were all carried out by the rebels. The fact is, actually, that these attacks that the Telegraph documented were carried out by by helicopters, which drop bombs laden with ammonia and chlorine gas on two villages. And guess what? Only one side in Syria's civil war actually has helicopters. So it's very clear who's responsible. But relying on Russia's sense of shame to change their behavior, I think, is a pretty futile enterprise.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Thank you. We've got a couple of comments on here. A lot of people are very worried about what the consequences of us taking action with Russia would be. One person asks if we are the best that the Kremlin propaganda regime can come up with, which is nice.
The Kremlin propaganda.
No, we are of course a tool of the Kremlin. It's always difficult to judge exactly how we will come out of these things as to whether or not we'll be judged as being pro-Russian or anti. But as a final concluding thought from both of you, is Russia really a serious long-term strategic threat, or is it simply a country which is in desperate straits and is a bear bellowing for attention?
I mean, the point is Russia wants to be a threat. Russia is rearming. They're spending a fortune on rebuilding their military capabilities, far more than we are in Britain, and that they have aspirations in this area. And how successful they are remains to be seen. They're very active in cyber, is another area that they're working very hard on. But I think what has happened in the last couple of months is that there's been an altogether different kind of reset in our attitude towards Russia. For the last 20 years or so, the Western powers have been trying to sort of draw Russia closer into our orbit. They've had cooperation deals with NATO, trade agreements with the EU, etc. And we've tried to sort of bring Russia back into Europe. The Russians have shown that they don't really want to pursue this goal, and we have to amend our view accordingly. That would be my view.
Con Coughlin and David Blair, thank you both very much, and thank you for joining us on the Telegram. Dosvidaniya, and hope to see you next week.
Dobar dan.